You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Geraldine Brooks reported on the war in Bosnia as a journalist for The Wall Street Journal, and that experience informs her third novel, People of the Book. It's from Viking. Her previous novel, March, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2006, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Geraldine Brooks back to this show. Hi.
Thank you for having me, Lennon.
Now, this novel is narrated by an Australian book conservator, Hannah Heath, who goes to Bosnia to work on a rare medieval manuscript known as the Sarajevo Haggadah. Haggadah is the book read during the Jewish Passover Seder. What makes this particular Haggadah so important?
It's very old. It was created back around 1350. But the thing that's most unusual about it is that it's illuminated. It's full of these beautiful, lavish illustrations with rare pigments made of ground lapis lazuli and gold leaf. And this at a time when it was believed that Jews didn't illustrate because of the commandment, thou shalt not make any graven images or likeness of anything. So that commandment was thought to have suppressed figurative art among medieval Jews. But when this book came to light in the 1890s, it turned that idea on its head.
So it's a real book.
It's a real book, yeah.
When did you first hear about it?
I heard about it in the lightless bar of the unfortunately named Holiday Inn during the Siege of Sarajevo, which was the only functioning hotel in the city, and it was where all the journalists stayed. And you know how journalists like to gossip, so at the end of the day, we'd sit around and have a stiff one at the candlelit bar because there was no electricity. And people were talking about this priceless gem of the Bosnian collections, and it was missing at that time. Well, so many books were destroyed in that war. The Serbs deliberately targeted the National Library of Bosnia and the Oriental Institute, so I just thought, well, it probably was destroyed. But no, there are all these other rumors that the Muslim government had sold it to buy arms, that Mossad had sent a team in to save it because it's this priceless piece of Judaica. And a couple of years later, it was revealed that the true story was even more interesting, and that was that a Muslim librarian had risked his life in the first days of the war and gone in under intense shelling and cracked a safe and carried the book out to safety and hidden it for the duration of the war.
Have you seen it?
Yeah. I was really lucky when I started to think about doing this book. I happened to find out that the UN was funding conservation work on it. And so I immediately, you know, talked my way into the room while the conservator was actually working on it.
Were you thinking of it as a news story or as the germ of a book idea?
It had sort of taken root in my imagination. It had gone beyond news story because I found out the known history of the codex, and that was interesting enough. That time that the Muslim librarian saved it during the siege of Sarajevo was the second time that we know about it was saved by Muslim hands. It had also been saved by a librarian, Islamic scholar from the Nazis during World War II. So the facts were fantastic, but what was even more intriguing to me were the mysteries and the things that you can't find out by research, which is why was this book illustrated? Who made it? How did it survive the expulsion of the Jews from Spain when so many Jewish books were lost at that time? We know it was in Venice in 1609, and at that point a Catholic priest saves it from being burned in the Inquisition there. So all these things we couldn't know the whys of, and that's the kind of void that I really love, to explore the mysteries through the vehicle of fiction.
And you used the history of this book as a way of telling this story. I don't want to give away too much of the plot of the novel, but how did it wind up in Sarajevo, which has never had a large Jewish population?
Well, actually, Sarajevo has had a significant Jewish population since about 1560s, and it was Spanish Jews who'd been expelled, and most of them first went to closer places like Portugal and Italy, and then they didn't do very well there, and they got kicked out again, or there were great persecutions. And the Ottoman Sultan at that time said, come to my realms, because you're skilled people, and we can use your skills. And you can live, you have to pay higher taxes than Muslims, but you can live unmolested. And so Sarajevo is emerging as a crossroads town. And there was a Jewish community there, and they lived humble, little noticed lives as artisans and traders.
Where does the title, People of the Book, come from? I'm assuming this is one of those things that has multiple meanings.
Well, it does. It's actually in the Quran. Christians and Jews are referred to as the other people of the book because they have a sacred text at the heart of their religion. And it just seemed to work for this because this is a story of the many times in the history of this book when Muslims and Christians have acted to protect this Jewish prayer book. And it's also about the people who just handled the book, owned it, protected it, risked their lives for it. And Hannah, the conservator, is very much a person of the book because she lives to unlock the secrets of ancient manuscripts.
My guest is Geraldine Brooks, whose latest novel is People of the Book, which is published by Viking. Your last novel, March, was a fictional account of the life of the father of the girls in Louisa May Alcott's Little Women with his experiences in the Civil War. And your first novel, Year of Wonders, was about the effects of the Black Plague on an English village. Is there something that links all three of these books?
I think there is. I get teased a lot. People ask me, what's my thing with vicars? Because they all have religious men of the cloth in them. And so the first one was the rector of the town where the plague came, who's a leader of the community. And the second one, of course, Mr. March. We know from Louisa May Alcott was a preacher to the Union forces during the Civil War. And so I was being teased about those two. And then I said, if you think that's bad, my next book sounds like a barroom joke because there's a rabbi, a priest, and an imam.
But they all were inspired by historical events, although this is the closest to our time.
This one comes up into the near present and then jumps backward in time. And I think the other thing that links my work is that I continue to be intrigued by the question of who are we in a catastrophe? Does it draw us to be our best self or our worst self?
You wrote an article that was published in The New Yorker last month about Dervis Kurkut, an Islamic scholar who was the chief librarian of the Bosnian National Museum during World War II. What was his part in the story of the Haggadah?
He was the librarian who saved the Haggadah when the Nazis came looking for it. Hitler had this notion that after he'd destroyed the Jewish people in Europe, he was going to have a museum of the extinct race. And he had actually set aside some buildings in the Jewish neighborhoods of Prague where everything else had been destroyed, but there were these three important Jewish buildings that had been kept for this purpose. And it was going to be a kind of depraved Jewish Disneyland where they would have Czech actors dressed up as Hasids walking around, and then the citizens of the Thousand Year Reich could come and be entertained. And to further the ends of this museum, they were looting the most beautiful and important works of Judaica from all the great collections of Europe. And they wanted the Haggadah. And the librarian was a linguist, and he'd been called to translate for this general when he came to talk to the director of the museum. And he knew straight away what was up. And so he stuffed the Haggadah down the waistband of his trousers and pulled his coat over it and went and charmingly translated and then walked out the door with this thing in his possession.
Well, he was a rather brave man. He also saved a young Jewish girl.
He did.
And the you mentioned the more modern story, the one that occurred with another librarian saving the Haggadah. I guess librarians are a lot more heroic than I ever imagined.
They're a very gutsy lot, I'll tell you. There was actually a woman librarian that I heard about when I was covering the war who was killed, spent her life evacuating the books from the burning National Library.
And in this case, the librarian who saved it is the love interest for Hannah. Hannah's been hired by the UN to examine and stabilize the Haggadah when it's discovered after the war. Did you talk to the real conservator who did that kind of work?
I was with her while she was working on the book, so I got to observe that. And then I also interviewed the librarian who had saved the codex under shelling, but I rush to say that my characters have nothing to do with either of those real people, only their actions.
Hannah is adamant that she be called a conservator and not a restorer. What's the difference? And is this a matter of contention in the world of rare books and
manuscripts?
Yeah,
it is. It's a very touchy subject because some people say, oh, well, what we're supposed to do is get rid of all the stains and fix the damage and make it back as close to perfect as we can. And others say, no, that's a complete betrayal of the book because we have to take a book as we receive it from the past and its wear and damage is part of its history. So there are two distinct schools of thought on it.
And also, someone like Hannah has to learn how to do all the stuff that was done when the book was first created. She has to know how to prepare gold leaf, parchment, pigments. And she believes that conservators must learn to prepare those materials exactly as they were when the manuscripts were created. I don't know whether that's something that conservators believe.
It's true. It's true. And actually, Andrea Pataki, who was the conservator who worked on the Haggadah, told me that she had been traipsing all around the city trying to find some calf's appendix because she was trying to make gold leaf the traditional way and you have to beat it on calf's appendix. And she was saying, I can't tell you how difficult it is to find a meter of calf's appendix.
Now, why does it matter if she makes white pigment from covering lead bars with wine dregs and then burying them in manure or finding a calf's appendix? Would it be all that different if she were able to come up with a similar pigment simply made by mixing chemicals that are available now?
I think visually it would probably be the same, but what she's trying to do is understand the old crafts because for her, and this is my fictional character I'm talking about now, part of her mission is to try and think her way back into the history of the book, to try and learn more about how it was made and who might have made it and where it might have been. So for her, it's very important to be historically accurate because that's the portal through which she can find out and add to our information.
And Hannah finds tiny clues to the book's history when she takes it apart, an insect wing, a wine stain, salt crystals, a hair, and each of those themes introduces a chapter detailing another part of the book's journey. But I was wondering if it's similar to what a reporter does when she's tracking down a story.
I think there are some similarities about it. I think, you know, that quest to add your grain of sand to the sandbox of human knowledge and to figure out how it all works. I think if you don't have that drive as a reporter, it'll be a pretty arid profession for you.
A number of reviewers have mentioned the Da Vinci Code, Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose, also A.S. Byatt's Possession in connection with this book. But I was reminded of James Michener's The Source, which tells the story of an archaeological excavation alternating the fictional accounts of life at each level of the site. Had you read that book?
I read that book when I was about 12 years old. I devoured that book.
So that was an inspiration, obviously.
I'm sure it was there in the back of my mind, yeah.
Why do you think there's such a strong market for popular novels centered on scholarly investigations?
I don't know, but I love them.
Uh-huh.
So I always write what I want to read, so I guess I'm right in the mainstream there.
Well, March won the Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago. Did that convince you to make fiction your primary medium?
I was already of the point of view that I would do this for as long as I could possibly get away with it.
You don't want to go back to reporting at all?
I had a few pangs where I was missing the sense of being witness to history, particularly when the Taliban fell in Afghanistan, because the women's story there was one I felt particularly equipped to tell. But I had a young child, and I always wanted to give my kid the same kind of childhood I had, which was not one where mum was off on a long open-ended assignment. And then when Danny Pearl was killed, I sort of thought to myself, who are you kidding? It's a different world out there now.
It's interesting that the places you covered, Bosnia is probably the most peaceful now, but Somalia, the Middle East, are still hot spots. And you do some journalism, as I mentioned. There was the piece in The New Yorker.
Well, the piece in The New Yorker was, I kind of think of that as the compost heap from the novel in a way, because and I love my compost heap, I hasten to say. It's a very precious part of my garden. But what I had was a factual story that was so good that it was almost too good. If I had have put that whole story into fiction, nobody would have believed it. They would have said melodrama. This couldn't happen because what really happened with that librarian was he saved this Jewish woman. And then a generation later, something that she did saved his daughter. And it's a story of a debt repaid decades later that you wouldn't dare to make up.
Well, novelists have often told me that one of the hardest things they had to go through in writing the book was sacrificing research that they had fallen in love with.
Yeah.
Great stories, but they just couldn't include everything.
So I think that that's very wise. I think you have to let the story drive the research, not vice versa. But I do find that when I know something factually, I like to also write the factual story. And I was able to do that also with March, because I did a lot of research about Bronson Alcott, Louisa May Alcott's real father. And I ended up writing about him for The New Yorker, too. So I've been lucky to be able to have my cake and eat it.
I'm not going to ask you what the next project is, but I assume I'll be reading about it in The New Yorker before I read the novel.
I can tell you there's another vicar in it.
Of course. Geraldine Brooks' latest novel is People of the Book, and it is published by Viking. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Lena.